Continuing now with our study of terms particularly used in the New Testament to describe the kind of content which would be poured into the models of spiritual guidance that existed in the ancient world, we turn now to the terms for shepherd, guide, and angel. As I've mentioned at the very top of this page, the term shepherd was used in classical antiquity and in ancient Israel to describe rulers, and in the case of classical antiquity, even to describe deities, gods who were particularly like shepherds in a very positive way, who were compassionate, concerned, gathering, caring in regard to humanity. Now, in fact, in antiquity, such deities were fairly rare, and so it was a kind of an optimistic and more philosophical model than an actual pastoral one. But in fact, that imagery already existed before the time of Jesus, as we'll see, but Jesus applies it to himself as good shepherd and as chief shepherd in a way that then allows for his disciples, for his followers, also to continue this ministry of shepherding, which is not just a ministry of ruling or of leading in the Christian community, but includes such images as gathering together, being concerned for the lost, taking a particular interest in those who are marginalized, and even being willing to undergo pain, suffering, and possibly death for the sake of the sheep. So all of this Christ takes to himself, and then it becomes something which is to be modeled by those who follow him. There's a great deal in this, obviously, very clearly, for those who are interested in spiritual guidance, the motives of compassion, concern, and being aware of the tendency towards being marginalized or lost. The terms guide and, it might seem a little paradoxical, angel also describe a New Testament imagery which is used for similar kinds of ministries. A guide in particular is a metaphorical way of understanding a kind of leadership that is intended to lead back to God, to guide the person who has gone astray or is unable to see clearly, to enable that person to see more specifically the will of God in their lives. And then, as we'll see, the notion of angel, which initially had a notion of one who is sent as a messenger, but which eventually also came to acquire the significance in the metaphysical sense of the angels as spiritual beings entrusted with ministries of companionship, guarding, protecting, and even interceding, praying for others. So that becomes very significant, as we'll see when we begin to look to the ministry of the martyrs in the early Christian church. But let's turn to each of these terms in turn by dropping down now to the red background text that describes the shepherd. Notice that in the ancient world, as I mentioned, there was already the concept of the shepherd who gathers the dispersed, that is, those who are lost or scattered, and is concerned for the weak. And this, you might call it shepherd function, existed not only in ancient Israel in regard to heroic kings of the past, but even in a more ancient way, it was to be found in ancient Egypt, as the smaller text here describes, and as you can read in great detail if you download the texts from the course documents section of the course. In the Old Testament, this imagery of shepherd is used both for ancient kings, although strangely not for living kings. It was something that was used to describe the heroic, good shepherd of the past. But in particular, it comes to be used in reference to God Yahweh, particularly in the prophetic imagery. It's a reference to this notion, this very real imagery of being a shepherd in Palestine, which, as the text describes, was independent, job, a responsible job, and it was very dangerous. It could well be dangerous in terms of the exposure to the possibility of attack, and often it was done by hired shepherds, by individuals who were not actually the owners of the flock. And as we'll see, that became a problem in rabbinic times because shepherds tend to be regarded with deep suspicion as people who were not being responsible, but in fact were thieves and charlatans. Well, that's not the case in the ancient tradition of Israel, nor is it, of course, the tradition for Jesus. The shepherd, rather, is one who goes before the flock, particularly in the notion of shepherd imagery applied to God Yahweh, who guides, leads, pastures, gathers, carries lambs, and then leads the mother sheep. It also becomes a particular title for the expected Messiah, for the one who will come, and he is going to be the chief shepherd who will call to account the bad shepherds, those who did not lead the people of Israel as they ought to have done. Now, interestingly, and by way of contrast, note in section 1-4 that in the rabbinical texts, very often the profession of shepherd is regarded with suspicion because of the practical reality that some shepherds did take the sheep that they were supposed to be taking care of, and instead they would sell them on the side or sell the milk. And so you were not supposed to take things from these shepherds or buy things from them for fear that it might be stolen goods. And this rabbinical suspicion is contrasted, if we drop down to section 1-3, with Christ's own imagery of the shepherd. As you note here, the shepherd is not regarded adversely in the New Testament. Perhaps this has to do, as the highlighted text shows, with Jesus' own experience of shepherds. Perhaps his high estimation of and his willingness to use this imagery, which comes from ancient Israel and is in rather significant contrast to the suspicion of the developing rabbinical tradition, perhaps this has to do with Jesus' own experience of ordinary people, of men who actually were shepherds themselves. And so he appreciates in a very sympathetic way these people who belonged to the context of the despised, who were regarded as sinners. It's solidarity with this ostracized or suspect group, which he then re-elevates again, following ancient tradition, to a model of God's love. And in section 1-3-2, Jesus describes, as we know, describing himself as the good shepherd, and in a number of the parables, describes God as the rejoicing shepherd, filled with joy at bringing back the lost, bringing sinners home, gathering the dispersed flock. And here again, rather like the ancient image of the shepherd associated with the coming Messiah, Jesus' description of the shepherd is also a gathering that has to do with the coming age of salvation. Not exclusively, but it does have an eschatological aspect to it. And Christ himself in section 1-3-3 is the chief shepherd. His unique role is to have responsibility for all of those who will then also carry on ministries of shepherding the flock. Dropping down to section 1-3, the title shepherd is, of course, the direct antecedent of the term pastor, which simply means a shepherd. And so the pastors of the church tend to be regarded using this shepherd imagery. And indeed, the term shepherd is often used to describe the church leaders in a variety of contexts and in texts that are described in section 1-4-1. Their pastoral task is to care for the congregation, to seek out the lost, to combat error and heresy, and to fulfill the task by being examples for the flock. Again, as we will see, when we look at the example of the martyrs, those church leaders who were willing to be good shepherds, who literally gave up their lives for their flock, following the example of Christ, who were willing to be killed rather than allow their flock to suffer. There's a reference which we won't spend a lot of time on here because we'll be looking at a text from Hermas a little later on in the course, but there is this very early document from the early church, from the late first up through the middle of the second century in Rome, called the Shepherd of Hermas, in which this imagery of the shepherd is also a kind, and this is an apocryphal document, of course, is an image of God's compassionate care, reaching out to be companion, instructor, guardian, and ministry of reconciliation for those Christians who have fallen again into sin. And it provides a kind of an image that is a reminder of the possibility of returning again to truth, to return again to God. If we drop down now to section 2, to the word guide, hodegos, which literally means the one who guides along the way or the path. This is the person who helps an individual find the path when the path is obscure or difficult to locate. Literally, in classical antiquity, it was the one who was the leader on a path or a way. It meant more symbolically or figuratively, already in classical antiquity, a teacher or a guide, one who would instruct or lead or show the way. In the Old Testament, if we drop down to section 2:2:1, it's used to describe the guide, which is to say, which is God, in the sense of the pillar of fire, which showed the way to the people of Israel on their journey. So God is the one who shows the way, who shows the path. And it is primarily God in the Old Testament who is described as this pathfinder, this leader, this guide along the way. It's also used, dropping to section 2:2:2, to describe accompanying angels, this developing notion that God is present through the ministry of spirits, through the ministry of others, who guide and show one on the way. This is present in the rabbinical documents, and of course, to a very great extent, it's also found in the book of Tobit, where there's literally the angel Raphael accompanying Tobias on his journey. If we drop now down to section 2:3 and look at the New Testament, here there is in the Gospel of John the idea that the Spirit of Truth will guide. Hodegese, a variant on this term, will be the one to guide you into all truth. So it is a continuing function of God in the Holy Spirit to lead one back onto or to discover again the path. Now, looking rather in concluding our discussion at the term angel, we think of it, of course, primarily in this metaphysical sense of spiritual beings, but in classical antiquity, if we look at section 3:1, the term literally means messenger. And that is the sense, the primary sense that it still has in the New Testament. And of course, the angels are above all else messengers, one who bear the word of God, who serve as intermediaries between God and human beings. But in classical antiquity, it was used of human beings, one who brings a message. And these individuals were not to be tampered with. Their persons were sacred. They were not to be harmed if the message they brought was regarded as negative. And occasionally, in section 3:1:2, the term could be used both to heavenly messengers and those who bring messages from the underworld as well. In the Old Testament, of course, the angelic becomes this rank of beings who are the ministers of, and in some cases, the mysterious presence of God Yahweh. And the most important notion of the angel in the Old Testament is this idea of the angel of the Lord, the angel of Yahweh, often not identified, not given a particular name, but simply God's angel, God's messenger, who, as we'll recall in the book of Exodus, is responsible for the plagues and for the preliminary aspects of bringing out the people of Israel. God goes with his people, but because God is nameless, wordless, God's presence is manifested by this messenger, by the angel. And of course, the three angels in the story of Abraham offering hospitality becomes a classical image of the Blessed Trinity in the later tradition. God's presence manifested in a guiding, leading, intermediary sort of way through this intermediary individual. There's a description of the development of angelology in the Old Testament in section 3:2:2 that we don't have to look at in detail. But it's important to notice that as the tradition develops, the Jewish tradition is very clear that the angels, although holy beings, although messengers of God, have limited holiness. And as we've already seen in the book of Enoch, there can be those angels who are tempted and who fall. There are angels whose purity is corrupted. They are not pure in comparison with God, but they have the role of guidance, of leadership, and in some cases even responsibility for whole nations. They can be called upon in time of need, and there's even a hint of an intercessory role which the angels engage in, which becomes a very important tradition later on. And again, remembering the book of Tobit, the angel carrying the prayers to the throne of God. In the New Testament, there is an imagery of active participation of angels, particularly in regard to Jesus' description of the last time. The role of the angels is particularly prominent in the discourses concerning the parousia of the last times. In section 3.3.3 here, in early Christianity, the angels take a dynamic part in the process of salvation history. They are described in the book of Revelation and in Hebrews as being an important part of this process of the unfolding of human history. And I like this very much. They are, Kittel says, chara. They are the things or the persons that cause joy. They are occasions of rejoicing in the development of the individual within history. The angelic can manifest that which causes joy. The angelic can be an experience of joy for the individual. There is a kind of an angelic function in which one perceives that God has been acting through intermediaries in one's own life, and that becomes a source and a cause of rejoicing. This is obviously something that's very directly linked to the notion of spiritual guidance and of leadership to help one perceive these chara, to help one perceive these events, these moments that are reflections of the love and the joy of God that may not be seen at the time, but are later perceived to have been points where one was indeed accompanied, where God was journeying with one. And through the intermediary of another, one can perceive the significance of these events. And so in section 3.3.5, there is this imagery of the guardian or the directing or the ministering angel, which Christ specifically refers to, and in particular in Matthew 18, the angels responsible for the little ones who behold the face of God, these angels that are directly in relationship with God and yet are caring for those who are at the margins, who are regarded as the least important, but Christ uses the model or the notion of the angelic to remind one of the fact that those who seem to be dispossessed, those who seem to be unimportant, are in fact important to God, whose all-embracing love reaches out to them. So this image of the angel is a reminder of the fact that God interacts with humankind through intermediaries. He allows others to be the means by which His grace and His love is manifested, and so to that extent, the spiritual guide, the spiritual director is serving in this kind of path-finding way, this pastoral or shepherding way, and indeed this angelic function of being an intermediary, helping individuals discover these sources, these moments, these events that were in fact God's presence in their lives, though they may not have been seen as such at the time, and who take on a responsibility for a kind of guardianship, a kind of directing of those who are seeking to discover in their lives more clearly the path and the way to God.